This week saw landslide elections in Japan, with the victors dominating parliament and having the ability to change the constitution. NATO is taking practical steps to take control away from the United States and hand it to European nations. US forces are also backing out of a key position in Syria and out of Minneapolis. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. The winner of Japan's elections is not really a surprise, but the magnitude of the victory is remarkable. For the first time in Japan's post-war history, a single party has a two-thirds majority in their parliament. Here to tell us what happened and its implications, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Shark.
Yes, that's right. Japan's hawkish new prime minister scored a massive victory in elections this week, and this victory empowers her to officially end Japan's post-war political era and to just dramatically accelerate Japan's already rapid remilitarization. So it was on Sunday that snap elections were held. Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi knew that she was just wildly popular among the Japanese people. She had consistently polled around 70% with her approval ratings since she became prime minister back in October. That's just stratospheric, really, for any country. But the people just love her for her Margaret Thatcher mentality toward governance, her economic revitalization, and above all, for her refusal to give in to China's bullying. So she has been just remarkably popular, and she wanted to translate all of that popularity into more seats for her party, the Liberal Democratic Party. So she called for these snap elections last month, and it was a little bit of a gamble, but it paid off spectacularly. This victory gave Takaichi's party 316 out of 465 seats. So as you said, that is a super majority, which is just unheard of in the modern era. It is, as you mentioned there in the introduction, the first time since World War II that any single party has held a two-thirds majority. And this means Takaichi's party will be able to override rejections of bills in the upper house, and they'll be able to propose constitutional amendments. So the Liberal Democratic Party does have a mandate now that's strong enough to be able to turn Takaichi's vision of Japan's future into a reality. And her vision is one of a far more militant, far more assertive Japan. You know, even before this landslide election, Takaichi had Japan on course to hit its goal of spending 2% of GDP on military by next month. That was 2 years ahead of what was already a tremendously ambitious schedule. So all of this money, billions of dollars, will be spent toward giving Japan's armed forces all kinds of cutting-edge drones and missiles and other extended-range weaponry. And we also have to keep in mind that during her campaign, Takaichi specifically called for a revision of Article 9 of Japan's constitution. That is the so-called pacifist clause that was intended to keep Japan from returning to full militarism. So revising that could remove all remaining restraints on Japan's firepower, just a massive development. And then at the same time, we've also heard statements from Takaichi's government saying Japan should get nuclear weapons. They've been under America's nuclear umbrella since the end of World War II, pretty much. But now they see that America is unpredictable and erratic and even contemptuous toward its allies in many cases. So the Japanese know that they can't depend on the United States for protection, and they think that they may need their own nuclear arsenal. So all of this means Japan is very much on the warpath. This new supermajority for the hawkish prime minister, it'll accelerate what was already a very rapid military buildup, and we very well could see constitutional revision and even a Japanese nuclear arsenal in the months and years ahead. And it is true that right now, the main factor driving this is Japan's fear of China. The Japanese see the Chinese amassing astonishing military power and growing more and more belligerent and assertive. And so the Japanese people are really empowering their leaders and you know, to arm the nation as never before so that they can be ready to face China. So that is the dynamic right now, but we should not expect that to remain the situation, because biblical prophecy shows that Japan and China will soon actually be allied together under Russian leadership, if only briefly. Right now, it's hard to imagine, given the current animosity and the current trends, but the scriptures show that that is the outcome that we should expect. So it's something that eventually will, you know, dramatically change. And we have an article that takes a close look at those scriptures. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches, Japan's March Toward Militarism. This article shows that we should be very concerned about Japan's rapid military buildup, which will now be accelerating so much more.
So what remaining restraints are there on Japan's constitution? I mean, in theory, they're banned from having a military at all, and they don't have an army, they don't have a navy, they have a self-defense force that is one of the most powerful navies on the planet. And you mentioned nuclear weapons. What else could we see change with the ability to change the constitution, or what would happen if they're able to withdraw that part of the constitution?
Well, back in 2013 and 2014, there was a major, not a revision of the constitution, but a reinterpretation is how they branded it. And what it basically did is it allowed Japan to station troops abroad, but only if it was under something called collective self-defense. So if America had troops abroad, for example, they would be able to deploy alongside those in what they called peacekeeping roles and various sort of tangential or auxiliary roles. So that reinterpretation was significant. But if this constitution is totally revised, then Japan wouldn't need any of those pretexts. It wouldn't have any of the caveats of, oh, well, America already needs to be involved in a conflict before Japan can go join it under collective self-defense. They could deploy troops anywhere they want to legally without having an ally already with troops in that theater. So that's that would be very significant. And then there's also things like aircraft carriers, for example. Japan has skirted the ban on offensive weaponry by having things like helicopter carriers instead of aircraft carriers, which are basically, they have been aircraft carriers that could be used offensively. But with this revision, they could build much larger carriers that they don't have to pretend like they're constraining the specs to make them small enough to not qualify as something offensive. We could start to see a lot more emphasis on a blue water navy that can go far from Japan's coast, although they have been, you know, quietly building up naval capabilities that are in many ways blue water. So you're right. In some ways, at this point, a true revision would be somewhat of a technicality, but there are still some major stipulations that I think could be lifted.
Thanks for that. And then also, I've seen a lot of talk about, you know, Donald Trump supporting the Japanese Prime Minister, she is one of the world leaders that he supports, I think, more vocally and more often than almost anyone else. How much did his support, do you think, make a difference in her election? I get the impression that it's significant that he supports her, but maybe it didn't actually change too many minds in Japan. But I'm curious to know what you think about that. And what's the Japanese perspective of Donald Trump in Japan? If a politician he supports just also won by a landslide, are they maybe more friendly to Donald Trump than Europe, where there's just a very widespread disapproval of him?
Yes, it is true that Prime Minister Takayuki and President Trump have a warm relationship, and we have seen the U.S.-Japan alliance strengthen under her tenure so far. And I think that his endorsement of her and his support of her very well could have factored in to a degree. It's mostly about her standing up to China. You know, the Japanese and the Chinese, they have a centuries-old rivalry that's one of the most tense flashpoints and one of the most tense hatreds between two countries that you'll find on all of Earth, really. So that was probably the main factor. But, you know, President Trump's endorsement, I'm sure, may have factored in as well. The Japanese still recognize that they're very much entwined with the United States economically and militarily. So that would have factored in to a degree. The Japanese, though, they are aware of President Trump's kind of the jaundiced eye with which he looks upon allies. And they're very sobered to see him look upon Vladimir Putin as a peer, as a man who he can do business with, and to look upon Xi Jinping and even Kim Jong-un. I think the Japanese are very sobered to see President Trump with this very pragmatic, kind of transactional view of world affairs. And so on the whole, I think that the Japanese are quite sobered by what they view as a kind of a betrayal of Western values in President Trump. They've never seen a president like this who has very little affinity or allegiance toward longtime allies, even very valuable allies who have supported America when we invoked Article 5 after 9/11. We've turned against all those countries who sent troops to fight alongside ours, and yet we want to do deals with some of the worst tyrants on Earth. So the Japanese, of course, are an anomalous nation, very unique. You couldn't compare them to anyone else, and they do have a tendency toward fanaticism that is anomalous and toward dictatorial leadership as well. But in the entire post-war era, we've seen very little of that. So it's changing dramatically. It's changing very quickly there, and we'll have to see what happens with Takaichi. It's unexpected to have this happening under a female prime minister. You know, she's the very first female prime minister that they've ever had, but yet she appears to be the most hawkish, at least in recent decades.
And I think another part of President Trump's support and his role in this is, I think it would be very hard, or it would be a different case if you had a Japanese prime minister saying, let's rearm and let's even explore nuclear power, and you had a US president that said, no, this is a really bad idea. We don't want this. We will do everything we can to oppose you on this. Like, that would be a very different reality to what you have now, which is she's doing this and she's doing it with America, and at least with President Trump's very vocal and enthusiastic support. And so that probably does make it, okay, maybe, I mean, it seems she got such a landslide. It seems like she would have won the election without President Trump's support. But the turnaround to a military power is made a lot easier by President Trump being on their side. So this is the context that Mr. Hilliker brought up as well, and something I want to talk about as we get into the NATO piece, that we're kind of having another story now of America building up a rival. You know, they're building up Germany, they're building up and encouraging that being a united European military. Here they're building up a militaristic Japan as a buffer to China. But as you say, Bible prophecy shows that they're going to ultimately end up in the Chinese camp. So an important story to keep watching. What else do you have for us from Asia?
Yes, just one other story here about China's nuclear program. It was alleged this week that China conducted a secret nuclear weapons test back in 2020. That is according to testimony by Thomas DiNanno, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He said, "Today I can reveal that the U.S. government is aware that China has conducted nuclear explosive tests, including preparing for tests with designated yields in the hundreds of tons." End quote. So it's alarming that this test was apparently carried out and that the Chinese seem to have devised a new method to hinder seismic monitoring, so that it was almost impossible to even know that this test had taken place. So I think this is just one more indication of how supercharged and how perilous the world's nuclear weapons situation has become.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, right in line with that story of building up enemies or potential rivals of the United States, NATO confirmed this week that the United States is going to hand over all three of NATO's joint command forces to European nations. So Italy is going to take charge of Joint Force Command Naples over the Mediterranean. Germany and Poland are going to rotate command of Joint Force Command Brunsum in the Netherlands, which I think shows how much the Dutch have been absorbed into the German army that they don't even get a look in the command center in their own country. And then Britain is going to take charge of Joint Force Command Norfolk, which is Norfolk, Virginia, not Norfolk in the UK. It's the maritime, it's a part of the maritime command. But then the US is going to take control of NATO's maritime command that's in London. And they'll still have a role to play in those other commands. But this is an important step. We've seen NATO's generals and NATO's American officials say, we want to see a German heading up as the supreme commander of the Allied forces. We want Germany basically to lead NATO, to take America's place leading NATO. This is a practical step in that direction, saying, well, the Mediterranean flank, the North Atlantic and Arctic flank, the Eastern flank, they're all going to be led by Europeans at the operational level. This is something that is going to take a few months to follow through on. The German press agency, Deutsche Presseagentur, it talked about Germans now will take on more top positions within the military command structure because of this change. So we're starting to see practical steps in Germany handing over command to Europe. The Munich Security Conference begins today. The Alternative for Deutschland, this far-right German party, they're going to be attending there for the first time. I think there's going to be a lot of talk about this. And I think it's probably not a coincidence that America made this announcement in the run-up to the Munich Security Conference, that they want to really, you know, they're making a very tangible push now for Europe to take on more responsibility for its own defense. And I think they'll continue that at the Munich Security Conference. I mean, we'll see how that goes, and I'm sure we'll be back next week talking about it. But this will add a whole lot of momentum to this discussion of America basically stepping out of NATO, at least as far as Europe is concerned, and handing defense over to Europeans. And what is, I think, most surprising about this is at the same Munich Security Conference and during the same week, the divide between Europe and the United States is clearer and starker than ever. We had the Winter Olympics opening, I think pretty much as we were recording or a little bit afterwards last week. I think some of the games like curling got started a bit ahead of time. Your sports, the Olympic, they're all that usually get all the platitudes about bringing everyone together and unity. And what was it that you had the Thomas Bach, the former president of the International Olympic Committee? Sports always builds bridges. It never erects walls. And usually with the Olympics, there is at least a show of unity. And it's a facade, it's a papering over of divides, but at least there's there for show. This week, they didn't even manage that. You had J.D. Vance being booed when he appeared on the big screen last week on Friday. And then you had a YouGov poll showing that there's a stark decline in nations in Europe and viewing America as a friend and ally. It really is remarkable. This poll, I think the last time they did it was 2023, and so they're contrasting the percentage. You know, how many people say that the United States is generally a friend and an ally? And in 2023 in Denmark, it was 80%. 2026, 26%. Denmark is the starkest with the disagreement over Greenland. But France, 64% to 53%. That was actually one of the least affected. Germany, 70% in 2023 said America is a friend and ally. 41% said that in 2026. Spain is a similar decline, 73% in 2023, 39% in 2026. Even in the UK, 69% said they're a friend and ally in 2023, 46% in 2026. So America is building up Europe at exactly the same time as Europe is turning against America. And I think it ties right in with the Japan story, where America is working to empower Japan to militarize and to take responsibility for its own defense, to be able to fight for itself. And it's doing this in the belief that it's in America's interest. And the reality is going to be radically, radically different. Once these powers are independent of the United States, they're going to turn on the United States. And you see that in their attitude towards America already. And this is what Herbert W. Armstrong said about this in a radio broadcast very powerfully years ago.
This thing that is soon to come, this thing that is going to dumbfound the people of the world. I want to tell you, my friends, the politicians of the great nations that are actually helping to build this thing and don't realize that they're only building a Frankenstein that is going to turn on us. They're going to stand aghast when this thing happens. Your Bible says so. It's in the prophecies of Revelation 17, verse 8. The nations will wonder, all whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they behold this thing, it's coming. It's real. You're going to see it. You don't believe it now. I know most of you don't. Well, you just stick it back in the corner of your memory somewhere, and when it happens, then I think you'll believe it. You don't have to believe it now, but it's going to be mighty important, and you better remember. And you'll believe it when it happens.
And this has been going on for decades, building up Europe, building up Japan. That has been America's goal since the end of World War II. They've invested decades into building this Frankenstein's monster. But we're very close to the point now that it turns on the United States. Herbert W. Armstrong was right. And everything that you're seeing in Europe is happening exactly the way that he talked about. Now, part of the reasoning behind this is that America wants to pull out, America wants to cut defense costs. That's not just a trend in Europe, that's also a trend in the Middle East, where America is pulling out of a small but very critical point in Syria. It's a new story that I think it's easy to not appreciate the drama or the importance of at first. It's just another unfamiliar name that America is leaving in Syria. But tell us about it and why it matters. We'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, yesterday the U.S. military confirmed that it has withdrawn from the Al-Taf deconfliction zone in southeastern Syria. That is, has withdrawn. They've already left. They're just confirming what's already happened. At this point, America no longer has any meaningful presence, military presence, in Syria. The base was established years ago in the fight against the Islamic State. It also provided a small zone in southern Syria where anti-Assad militias, the militia that turned into the current government, but other, I guess you could say, more palatable groups were stationed in. But now the U.S. has withdrawn and given full control of the base and the surrounding territory to the new Syrian government of President Ahmed al-Sharaa. As I alluded to earlier, this follows America's abandonment of its Kurdish allies, which to this point was the largest military presence the U.S. had in Syria. So between leaving the Kurds and This is basically the U.S. government saying we fully trust the new government in Damascus to take control of everything. We don't need to give them supervision. We're out of here. We're sending our boys back home. Now, this particular base was located basically where Syria's border meets the borders of Jordan and Iraq. Very, very crucial geographic area, especially when you consider, before the successful revolution under Bashar al-Assad, Syria was a major sponsor of Iran, and it was the only territory between Iran and Iraq and the influence Iran has there, and Lebanon, which is where they sponsored Hezbollah, which was, by some accounts, the most armed non-state army in the world. So America having a base right there on the Syrian border with Iraq, that put a lot of leverage on Iran being able to sponsor Hezbollah and being able to do work in Syria, and also put a bit of a, at least somewhat of a check to it, as much as they could. The Syrian government that's taking over, we've talked about in this program before, they have a lot of jihadist sympathizers within their ranks. The regime is a former affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Until recently, Sharaa had his a bounty on his head due to him leading a terror group. So there's that aspect on, do you really trust these kind of people to govern all of Syria? But also, his government is pretty shaky. Even the amount of control he has over his own troops is questionable, and certainly the amount of control he has over these other little patch of territory that may not be under his militia's direct control. And so the idea, even taking the terrorist aspect out of it, that his government would be a reliable policing agent for this notoriously very porous border begs into question if we're going to see a lot more chaos in this part of the world, a lot more infiltration from terror groups, and perhaps even an attempt by Iran to get some of its old networks back.
So, do you think this is going to lead to greater Iranian presence, control in Syria?
I don't think it's going to lead to greater control. I think Iran has settled that they're going to cut their losses and that they are going to move on from that. But I do think this gives them an opportunity to strengthen a lot of those connections. I mentioned Hezbollah, Iraq, they have a lot of terror groups under their sponsorship there, the Popular Mobilization Forces. You could see them maybe trying to get more involved in cross-border smuggling. Syria used to have a big drug trade. And of course, Syria also directly borders Israel, which is the big prize of Iran and all these different terror groups. And if the US, the base may not have been near the Israeli border, but it was pretty close. And if you wanted to travel from Iraq or from some of these other places to the Israeli border, you would have had to go near this US base. And the fact that that's not only is that out of the way, but that also means US intelligence monitoring services from that area are going to be a bit limited. Maybe some of the early warning systems Israel was relying on. If you wanted to attack Israel, now would be a much easier time to do so than, say, this time 6 months ago.
So that's how it affects Israel, which I think obviously we're pretty interested in watching. But what about the rest of the countries in the region?
Well, as I mentioned, Jordan also has a border in that area as well. And Jordan is a close American ally. It's not a democracy, but it has much better levels of freedom than most other areas in or countries in the region. They aren't necessarily fans of jihadist groups taking over an area close to them. They have their own problems with Islamic extremism and are trying very hard to fight it, and probably couldn't do it without America and the US soldiers based in Jordan helping them out. So that is probably going to rattle them quite a bit as well. There's other US partner There are other countries, though, like Turkey, for example, which is a major backer of the Syrian regime, that probably likes this as well, because the fewer American troops are in Syria, the more Turkey can get away with consolidating that into part of the world into their sphere of influence. But in a nutshell, most of the countries that don't want to see radical jihadism spread around the region, like Israel, like Jordan, they're not going to like this. But countries like Turkey, Qatar, another really big sponsor of the rebel groups, this is going to help boost their power and influence in the region.
Now, for any regular listeners to the show, we've been talking quite a bit about Syria breaking away from the Iranian orbit, and that Mr. Flory wrote about this happening right at the start of the civil war, the Syrian civil war. He said this Syrian civil war is going to end with Syria breaking away from Iran. That happened. Now here we're talking about a story where Iran is potentially getting more control or an opportunity to establish some more control in the area. How does this, why are we watching this from a prophetic standpoint?
Well, the main prophecy concerning Iran is in Daniel 11, verse 40, which speaks about a king of the south and a king of the north clashing over territory in the Middle East. And Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, talks about this in more detail, but prophetically speaking, the King of the North represents Europe and Germany and Europe's interest in the Middle East, and the King of the South is Iran and its proxies and allies under the banner of radical Islam. So and you can read the rest of the prophecy. It talks about this being the catalyst that starts World War III. America's nowhere in the picture in this story. America's not even the target of Iran's big push. At this point, America's almost a side note. And Mr. Fleury mentions in The King of the South that America's absence in this prophecy is an ominous warning of all the problems that are going to befall America and how much they're not going to have power anymore to be involved anywhere in the world. But you could, by extrapolating from that, you could see America being absent from here is also helping cause a lot of these crises, a lot of these clashes to happen, causing the rise of Iran, the rise of radical Islam, causing a lot of these other countries like Syria realizing we can't rely on America. America's not here. They don't want to have anything to do with us. We're going to have to look for another ally. Let's see what Europe's up to. And President Trump was thinking about doing something similar to this during his first term. He didn't end up following through. But this is what we wrote at the time. This was from an article in 2019. Quote, President Trump's withdrawal from Syria has damaged America's credibility in the region. In the tumultuous Middle East, reliability and predictability are essential in attributes in an ally. End quote. Now, that was just talking about what everybody was thinking in 2019 when President Trump was thinking about withdrawing from Syria. Now he has done that. Not only has he done that, but he's given basically an Al-Qaeda affiliate control over the country. You would think the last group any American administration would want to hand over all these sections of the Middle East to. And okay, maybe the government in Syria is enjoying this increase in their power, but all these other countries in the region, they're looking at that going, America's, like what we were talking about with NATO and Japan, America's not a reliable partner. They don't want to defend us. They don't want to have anything to do with us. We're going to have to look elsewhere. And Syria, for their part, deep down, they know that, okay, it's good to consolidate their territory, but America's not going to be helping us out either. They're giving us this land back because they don't want to be helping us. The Syrians, they don't like the Kurds, but they see that the Kurds are American allies, and they could see how America treated their allies, and they know deep down that America is unreliable. And we've talked before plenty on our different resources, how this power vacuum of America leaving the Middle East is going to be the cause, physically speaking, of all these different powers coming and filling the void, all these different powers realizing we have place to maneuver now, we can grow now, and America is not going to get in the way. And this is going to be the catalyst for the catalyst, the start of World War III starting in the Middle East. And if our viewers would like to learn more about that, the article I cited is called America is Backing Out, which we could put a link for in the show notes.
Well, just like we were talking about with what's happening in Europe, what's happening in Japan, you can see these prophecies that we've been talking about for decades that Herbert W. Armstrong spoke eloquently about. You can see how they've begun to happen, how they're set to continue to play out. What else do you have for us from the Middle East, Mihailo?
Well, the start of the week, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made a multi-trip visit to Australia in the wake of the Bondi Beach massacre, which happened in December, on official invitation from the Australian government. This is the president, this is not the prime minister, this is not the executor of government policy. And Herzog himself belongs to Israel's center-left. He used to be Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's biggest political adversary. He would be like the one Israeli in any kind of influence, you would think the Get Bibi crowd, the Israel is an evil state crowd would have some respect for. But you still had thousands of protesters show up in Sydney and throughout the rest of the country, basically calling for the Australian government to arrest him as a war criminal, which the international courts are after Netanyahu, they're not after him. And to basically say that he is an evil man that needs to be punished. And you had some skirmishes with the police, between the police and the protesters, actually get quite violent, and even one police station surrounded by hundreds of people, basically accusing them of being collaborators with Herzog. I think that's a big, very telling example about what this from the river to the sea Israel is an evil state protest is really about. In this case, it's not Netanyahu. It's not anybody responsible for anything he's accused of doing. And yet they still want his head because he's Israeli, because he is Jewish, basically. And it shows a lot of the undercurrents of anti-Semitism, which we've written about in our latest print edition, that is affecting Australia and other parts of the world and how serious it is. Speaking of Prime Minister Netanyahu, on Wednesday he visited Washington, D.C. for a meeting with President Trump. This was pretty hastily called and apparently has to do with President Trump's ongoing nuclear negotiations with Iran, which we spoke about last week. The statements that we got both from President Trump and Netanyahu suggests that no agreement has been reached and that there was some differencing of opinion, which sounds like Mr. Netanyahu wasn't able to dissuade any moving forward with the negotiations. This could very well be a bluff, like the split between the two of them was last time around in June, right before they were going to strike Iran's nuclear program. And today, right as the U.S. is sending another aircraft carrier to the Middle East, is doing a bit more saber-rattling in that region. But either way, a lot of high stakes and a lot of clashing interests going on in that front. And then finally, one last story, a more of a trend, but it's a good time to talk about it, of gang violence erupting in Israel, specifically among the Arab community, which has been hit with a murder within the Arab community, almost averaging out once a day since the start of the year, basically through turf wars and other skirmishes between different Arab-affiliated gangs. These are gangs, these are not terrorist groups, so these are not jihadis like setting a bomb off in a mall, but more more what is commonplace in places like Mexico, with just these criminal groups getting so much influence, they basically become the governing authority. They have military-grade weapons, they often raid IDF posts, so these are quite seriously armed groups, and just more internal division within Israel itself.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. What we've talked about so far with the Middle East, especially with Europe and Japan, is threats to the United States rising. But a critical part of this story as well is the internal threat in the United States, the division that threatens to bring down America. There have been some important developments on that front. And to get the latest there, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, internal divisions within the United States are a very serious and increasingly common threat here. We had a big announcement this week, just yesterday, by our border czar here in the United States, Tom Homan. Donald Trump sent him to Minneapolis to take care of the basically the rising insurrection against immigration and customs enforcement officials there. And Mr. Homan announced yesterday that basically Operation Metro Surge is now a smashing success. It's no longer needed, and therefore the U.S. government will be withdrawing ICE agents from Minnesota. And so this is something we actually mentioned was a unique possibility here on this show, Trumpet World, a few weeks ago. We're wondering that, like, just in light of the rising opposition against Donald Trump's attempts to arrest and deport illegal immigrants, if he wouldn't blink or back down in this case. And it looks like that's definitely what happened. Now, President Trump and Tom Homan, they're definitely packaging this in a way that looks the least bad for the Trump administration, saying that, well, this operation's been a success, it's completed everything it set out to do, and is now no longer needed. Well, other magazines with a leftist tilt, like the American Prospect, are publishing headlines like the Occupying Army retreats. I saw one article that's even comparing the retreat of ICE from forces to like the retreat of the British from Boston in the American Revolution. So the left-wing media and left-wing politicians are painting this as a huge success for their side. I guess that's kind of common with stalemates where both sides can claim victory. It's just the ICE agents, they're retreating. Donald Trump's claiming this was a smashing success. the radical left's claiming this is a huge retreat. And so I looked at some of the statistics this morning before I came in the show, and I actually think the leftists have a little bit more to bolster their case that this is a success for the insurrectionist. As far as we know, there's about 130,000 illegal immigrants in the state of Minnesota. The Republican Party platform that Donald Trump was elected on, like the first two promises of that platform, like promise one was seal the border, and promise two was carrying out the largest deportation campaign in American history. Basically try to reverse all the illegal immigration that happened under the Biden administration. So the smashing success that Operation Metro Surge achieved is it arrested about 3,000 people. So 3,000, that's just over 2% of 130,000. So we basically arrested 2% of the illegal immigrants in Minnesota. In the process of doing that, three people died, two shot in confrontations with police, and then one who died of other causes in ICE custody. And it was those three deaths that prompted all the protests and riots and in Minnesota that initially had Trump openly mulling about invoking the Insurrection Act, sending in the National Guard to stop people from attacking ICE agents until they could arrest more than 2% of the illegal immigrants in Minnesota. But it seemed like the, like I said, the protesters, they really dug in their heels. It looked like invoking the Insurrection Act would have almost assuredly resulted in more than just three people dying. And so Donald Trump decided it was best to pull ICE out of Minnesota and then claim a victory. I guess you could argue that in a tense situation like that where more people was going to die, like maybe some initial restraint may have been wise. And then the victory is just kind of trying to like cover up the embarrassment that this was not nearly as successful as he wanted it to be. And as we've pointed out before on both this show and the Trumpet Daily Radio show, this is really a victory for the terrorist, as Mr. Stephen Fleury phrased it. That's going to set a precedent that in other states where you're deporting illegal immigrants, that if you can get some riots and you can get some protest going, you can get the federal government to back down. Which, prophetically, I think this is really significant because 2 years ago, or I guess year and a half ago, in 2024, we published at least two Trumpet covers that year. Two of our 10 Trumpet issues had illegal immigration on the cover. Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote an article in the spring of 2024 called Lawlessness by Design about the Biden administration letting illegal immigrants into the nation. And then I wrote one in the fall titled Expose the United States Invasion Route. Now, the article I wrote focused basically on the evidence we have that Joe Biden and Barack Obama were working together to let 10 million illegal immigrants into the country on purpose. It wasn't just an accident, it was on purpose. And it quotes there in the section of the article a statement by Mr. Gerald Fleury that he made in a sermon at the time, basically saying that Obama's plan is to intentionally import soldiers or agents who can sow division, terrorism, race riots, and civil war in the United States. That's based on prophecies in Ezekiel 5 and Isaiah 1 about civil war in the end time nations of Israel. Particularly a civil war that happens as foreign nations start economically besieging America and a civil war that's largely perpetrated by foreigners or strangers or aliens. Isaiah 1 and verse 7 highlights that, like your cities are burnt in your midst by strangers. And so we're definitely seeing now, with under President Trump's tariff policies and other just competition between nations, the groundwork being set for nations like the European Union and China and Latin America to economically besiege America. But the prophecy is pretty explicit that as that siege builds, the civil war in America will build. And so this has been a trend I've been watching pretty closely because I was thinking about this a lot, basically, as Donald Trump was inaugurated, because we'd had two trumpet covers highlighting these prophecies about these illegal immigrants causing rioting and protest and civil war-like conditions. And the statement from Mr. Gerald Flurry about Obama and Joe Biden purposely letting a lot of these people into the country exactly for that reason. But then you had a new president or returning president, Donald Trump, who, like, one of his big two promises on the Republican Party platform was seal the border and deport the illegal immigrants. And he's had great success in sealing the border, not nearly so much success in deporting the illegal immigrants. And I think it definitely has to be that way prophetically, because the prophecy is pretty explicit that unless the American people repent and turn to God, this civil war is one of the next big curses that's going to happen on America. Now, there's plenty enough illegal immigrants in the United States already to wage such a war, so we don't necessarily need to expect the border crisis to come roaring back. We don't necessarily need a ton more. But if President Trump was actually able to fulfill his campaign promise to, like, deport the 10 million people, you would have reversed the damage that Barack Obama and Joe Biden had done and made that prophecy something that could not be fulfilled. And sometimes prophecies are contingent. You've got the Jonah example in the Bible where, like, Jonah warned Nineveh, it repented, and the prophecy did not happen. So it's like those prophecies about civil war, I mean, they can be nixed or nullified if the American people repent. There's not any evidence of, like, a return to morality in America, though. So I think the pretty clear prophetic indication is that Donald Trump's attempts to deport these illegal immigrants, there's about 10 million that Joe Biden let in during his term, and probably about 20 million more. I think Yale University estimated 30 million's the most likely number. That his success in getting rid of those people is going to be limited, unless there's a huge change in the moral direction of the nation. And so this announcement that Tom Homan made yesterday, is definitely, I think, evidence along those lines. The fact that President Trump sent in the ICE agents. We had Operation Metro Surge. It deported about, or at least arrested, about 2% of the illegal immigrants that were in Minnesota and then had to back down just due to rioting and opposition from left-wing political activists in the country.
Yeah, this story does drive home the scale of the problems the United States faces. We played the clip a few weeks ago of Donald Trump where he came into office, he had his inaugural address, and he talked about how the country's more unified than ever. And he kind of painted this picture of, that's it, Barack Obama and the left are out of office, and now we're going to surge on to the sunlit uplands led by Donald Trump, and everyone is going to be united behind him. And it reminded me a bit of Britain after Brexit, where, you know, at the trumpet, we had a lot to say about Britain's EU membership is really damaging for the UK. And we also said well, Bible prophecy says that Britain is going to leave the European Union. And so that happened. And we said, look, Mr. Armstrong was right. He said in black and white, you know, Britain is not going to be part of this European Union. And you know, we knew that this was happening. This is fulfilled prophecy being fulfilled before your eyes. This is exciting. This is demonstration of God's power in world events. But we also had articles saying, you know, don't expect Britain to turn around. That you know, Nigel Farage is making it sound like that's it. We're going to have utopia. And this is going to be a massive turning point for Britain. And everything is going to be wonderful from here on out. And we were making the point, well, yeah, European Union membership was really bad for Britain. Yes, it's good in a lot of ways that we voted out of this, but our problems are a whole lot deeper than EU membership. And actually, a lot of these problems are self-inflicted. And now we're out of the EU. We have the opportunity to turn things around, the opportunity to fix a lot of our issues, but we have to take it. And really, because of our character flaws, we're not going to take it. And we're almost 10 years on from that now. And that's exactly what you've seen. We've left the EU and Britain is still a basket case and we're not in anywhere close to utopia. And there's still a whole lot of unhappiness about leaders that have just continued the same disastrous policies that we had under the EU. And it seemed like you had something similar with President Trump. He got rid of some really disastrous things that the Obama administration were doing. And his return was prophesied. But his return was not enough to turn around all of America's problems, because again, they're a whole lot deeper than just who happens to be the president. And so what is needed, both for America and for Britain and for the world, is a wholesale repentance and a fundamental change in our way of life, in our way of education, living, like economy, all of it. And just a superficial change isn't enough. And he's not going to be able to bring about the scale of change that we need he's not even going to pursue the changes that we need without repentance and then without God's help in that.
Yeah, those are all just really amazing points. And I feel like in our book, America Under Attack, it talks about this end time Jeroboam figure, this role that Donald Trump is fulfilling that saves Israel temporarily. But I feel like that word temporarily, what we're seeing under President Trump is more like a pause button on some of the problems, not even really reversing them. It's like he hit the pause button on all the illegal immigrants coming over the border. He's did arrest 2%, probably some of the most violent 2% in the country, in the state of Minnesota, which 2% is better than 0%. So it's a move in the right direction towards moving law and order in the country. But you've still got 98% of the illegal immigrants still there, still causing the same social problems there. I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago, where this is also just a symptom of a greater lawlessness problem in the nation. Like, Congress has passed laws determining who can come here legally and who can't. And right now, there's these protesters, they're not protesting so much for Congress to change the laws to make it easier for immigration, so much as they're protesting against, like, we don't even want the laws that currently exist to be enforced. And that attitude spills over, and not just against immigration law, but against other laws and against moral laws and against the Ten Commandments, that there's just a spirit of like anti-law or lawlessness in the country, that, like I said, that spirit's still there. Like I said, it might not have as strong a hold on the highest office in the land as it did 4 years ago, but it's still there amongst the people, and that is the root cause of the problem.
So yeah, this is, and it's an important component of the whole picture that we've been watching, the rise of Europe, the rise of other powers in Asia, and then America causing itself so many self-inflicted wounds that it's weakening itself to the point that these rival powers can threaten it. So an important story to keep watching. What else do we have from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, well, we'll do a few other stories in the English-speaking world. The first one from America again. We actually had a really interesting editorial in the New York Times this week titled, "It's Time for America to Admit It Has a Marijuana Problem." This is something that at the Trumpet we've been telling America that it's time to admit it has a marijuana problem for at least 10 years now. We have an article from Mr. Wick Hirma titled "What's Wrong with Marijuana" from back in 2013 that talks about the health problems, the social problems, the drug addiction problems, the crime problems, and other things that result from this drug. Now, back when we were writing those types of articles, the New York Times was pushing hard for marijuana legalization, and saying things. They wrote a six-part series on why marijuana should be legalized. They said that there's no evidence of why legalizing marijuana would lead to increased usage. There's no evidence that legalizing marijuana would be a gateway drug to other drugs. And now that most of the nation has listened to the New York Times more than it's listened to the Trumpet, and you have at least 26 of the states have legalized marijuana, and the results are in, now even the New York Times is admitting, like, oops, we got that wrong. It's time to admit we have a marijuana problem. Legalization has indeed led to increased usage. Legalization has indeed been a gateway drug into harder drugs. And it's even killed people with, again, driving under the influence of pot is not any different than, not any safer than driving under the influence of alcohol. So many social problems are resulting from this legalization. The Trumpet warned ahead of time would result. We were absolutely right about that. And the New York Times, I guess to its credit, has finally come out and admit that, like, yeah, we kind of messed up there. In other nations in the English-speaking world, there's definitely still social problems in Canada. A tragic story this week where 9 people were killed and 27 were injured in a school shooting in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia. The killer was a boy who identified as a girl, so they were transgender biologically, or in real life they were a boy, but they were masquerading as a girl. Obviously some deep mental problems, and that just picked up a gun and, like I said, killed 9 people, injured 27 others. This is kind of an interesting trend we've been watching. It seems like there's been a number of cases of transgender shooters of late. I actually tried to look at the statistics this morning to see if it's more likely for transgenders to be mass shooters than the rest of the population. Still a little early to tell on that, just because transgenderism's kind of a phenomenon that just took off in the last few years. From what I can tell, it looks like about 1.5% of the population is transgender, and maybe 1.5% of the of mass shooters are transgender. So it doesn't look like they're more likely. But again, this is obviously in this case, this is someone who's, well, living a lawless lifestyle, to tie it in with the other, with the trend we've been talking about, where there's obviously biological laws that God put in place that made them male, that they're rebelling against in their attempt to be female in a way that's verges on insanity. And so those mental problems obviously spilled over into other aspects of their life, causing them to do something like this. And then one final story, this one from Britain, just again highlighting some of the sexual degeneracy in the end time nations of Israel, but with a little bit of a positive spin this time to at least people being held to account, is that Morgan McSweeney, they're the chief of staff to British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, actually resigned this week. That she was involved in the appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the United States, who was involved with Jeffrey Epstein. Like I said, the convicted pedophile who's done, was involved with so many high-profile politicians around the world. It's actually been really sad here in the United States as our Justice Department, despite the fact that they've released over 3 million documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, has said that there will be no prosecution. So the United States isn't prosecuting anyone for the relationship to Epstein. I think the only high-profile figure who's resigned is Larry Summers, who wasn't forced to resign, but like he had some connections with Epstein that were just embarrassing enough that he resigned the position he had. It seems like Britain's doing not much more, but a little more, where you finally got Morgan McSweeney. You've got one resignation over the Epstein scandal. Prince Andrew, or Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, he's no longer a prince, has faced some consequences. I guess there's still a chance Keir Starmer may have to resign to some of his connections. He seems to have quite a bit of staying power, so I guess we'll see how that goes.
He appointed Peter Mandelson. I don't think he has connections to Epstein himself, but it's he made that decision to appoint Mandelson despite knowing a fair bit about, maybe not all of the latest details, but he knew that Mandelson and Epstein were friends.
Which means if he throws Morgan McSweeney under the bus, maybe he maybe he can stay on as prime minister. But yeah, good to see at least a couple people being held to account for sins they committed in office, or mistakes they've committed in office, at least appointing someone who was connected to someone else. But still sobering with those Epstein files to just see how widespread some of this perversion it is and how little has been done so far.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. And thank you for joining us today. We'll have links to all of the material that we mentioned in the show notes. We didn't really talk about too many booklets on today's show, so I'll leave you just with a mention of our free book, He Was Right. It's recently been updated. It is, I hope, better than ever, easier to follow than ever. A book that does the same thing that we've been doing on today's show and shows you how all of the major trends and news stories that are happening around the world come right from right from the Bible, ultimately, but right from what God revealed to Herbert W. Armstrong, and that he had all of these very specific things to say based on Bible prophecy decades ago, really, you know, the 20s, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and that describes the broad outlines of everything that we're seeing today. The America's retreat, the division within the United States, the way that Europe is coming together, the way that Japan is rising, even so many of these trends in the Middle East. It's all exactly as God revealed to Mr. Armstrong. And you can get that book on our website, thetrumpet.com, and it will show you where God is working today. It will show you the power of the Bible. And there's a lot of that's very practical things to be shown. And that one, as you see that demands action from you. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read it online, or again, as usual, we'd be very happy to send you a print copy that you can study alongside your Bible. Well, thank you very much to all of our panelists. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We will be back next week. And until then, keep watching your world.